and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Washington. Here are some of the top stories making news across South Sudan this Monday, July 29, 2024. Basketball fans across South Sudan celebrate the country's first win in the Olympics basketball game.
This game to South Sudanese is more than a game. Basketball brought us together as a time we are fighting for the liberation of our country. These boys, this team of South Sudan in Olympic brought us together.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. South Sudan's basketball fans in Malakal celebrated South Sudan's victory against Puerto Rico on Sunday. The fans say the game united them irrespective of their tribes and that South Sudan should focus on sports to bring medals home instead of conflict. For VOA News, Mamer Abraham Kwart reports from Malakal.
The Paris Olympic opening match between South Sudan and Puerto Rico drove fans in Upper Nile State's capital, Malakal, wild after the Bright Stars' victory over the weekend. Basketball fan Nyang Liet says the Olympic Games have united South Sudanese beyond tribal lines and other challenges facing people in the country.
This game to South Sudanese is more than a game. Basketball brought us together as a time we are fighting for the liberation of our country. These boys, this team of South Sudan in Olympic brought us together as one nation, regardless of our tribes, regardless of our challenges, regardless of whatever we are facing as a country. We are very, very proud South Sudanese, SSD to the world.
Tisi Alam is another patriotic supporter of the Bright Star. She believes a team will go all the way.
Honestly, I am very excited. I remember when the basketballers came in Juba, we had a very nice welcoming. We were so proud. And our flag is now so high. People are envying South Sudan. And we are very, very excited. Today's match is going to take us, that is, to the Olympics, and it's going to make us to the finals. We are very excited.
Apu Rebecca is one of the fans who say winning the game against Puerto Rico was a sign the Bright Stars will bring home the gold.
Tell the players we are so proud of them. South Sudan, keep their hope, keep praying. We are bringing this Olympic home. Conflict does not define us. Those are the differences we are having, but we are going to fix them through games.
Another fan, Boy Yap Yol, says the Bright Star has given South Sudan a new platform in Africa and the world.
I want to deliver this message to the leadership of our country. I've supported this event so that we can grow and we shall remain. This is the nation, of course, that has come together and said this to the world. Here we are. We are capable and we can do it. Run up!
Lily Adieu Martin-Manuel, press secretary in President Salva Kiir's office, says Mr. Kiir and the people of South Sudan are beyond proud of the Bright Star. In one of his speeches shared on X, formerly known as Twitter, John Garang de Mabior, South Sudan's founding father, predicted the potential of South Sudan several years ago.
We shall have our teams, so we shall be organizing our team to go for the African Cup or to go for World Cup. For example, England has four teams, South Sudan may have two or three teams. This is in the concurrent powers.
South Sudan takes on the USA on July 31st and Serbia on August 3rd. Fans say the Bright Star must win at least one of these games to secure a slot in the next stage of the Olympic basketball games in Paris. For VOA News, I am Amir Abraham Kwart reporting from Malakal, Upper Nile State.
Still on the Olympics, we move to Juba, where South Sudan basketball fans celebrated the first Olympic win by the Bright Star, with watch parties hosted across the town. The Secretary General of South Sudan's Basketball Federation says the party was not just in the capital, Juba, but outside the basketball stadium in Paris as well. Many South Sudanese fans took to social media demanding that Monday should be declared a public holiday. Juliana Shiapai reports for VOA from Juba.
The South Sudan basketball team, nicknamed the Bright Star, won their first Olympic game on Sunday, beating Puerto Rico 90-79. Aro Ramadan Chan, secretary of the South Sudan Basketball Federation, who is now in Paris for the games, says South Sudan's victory over Puerto Rico was unexpected by most people.
First of all, there was an amazing, beautiful turnout of Junubin from all over the world. They came to support. There was we also had our brothers and sisters from the other side, Sudan, you know, which was also a beautiful thing. So eventually, when we got the victory, it was a party. It was a beautiful party. Everybody enjoyed. Guys literally celebrated outside the stadium till late. It was a beautiful thing to see our people happy and bringing them together.
Roman Lopsali is a South Sudanese engineer and a basketball fan. Lopsali says Sunday's win was an eye-opener for many.
South Sudan win for the basketball team in the Olympics yesterday. It was not just a win for the sport. It is a win for the nations, especially as we're going through these critical financial situations and political challenges. This win gives us hope. This win gives us inspiration. This win changed our image to ourselves and to the world, that we as a South Sudan, we can do better. We are a nation full of hope, inspirations.
Alec Ajak is a South Sudanese basketball fan. She says Bright Star's first Olympic win gives her much joy.
Yesterday's basketball match between Puerto Rico and South Sudan, I'm really very proud of our team that have actually gained their first win. And I'm happy actually because they also represent South Sudan in the international community, and this is a really very great because I was really happy to see them winning the game yesterday, so I'm really happy for that.
Chan says the next game scheduled for July 31st against the USA is not going to be easy, adding that the Bright Star will approach the game with respect. South Sudan takes on Serbia on August 3rd. Fans are hopeful the Bright Stars will perform wonders. For VOA News, I'm Juliana Shiapai in Juba.
Still on the Olympics, Vincent Ligon is representing South Africa at the BMX freestyle event at the 2024 Paris Olympics. Ishan Hafjay has the 27-year-old cyclist's story.
Flying through the air and performing complex tricks on his bicycle at this skate park in Johannesburg, South African BMX rider Vincent Ligoni hopes his inclusion at the Olympic Games will inspire younger riders in South Africa and the African continent.
So, goal is top 10, but my ultimate goal out of all of this is actually just to bring the fun back in BMX.
BMX Freestyle returns for its second Olympic Games in Paris this year after making its debut in Tokyo in 2020. The competition will take place in an urban park where riders will perform as many tricks as possible in 60 seconds. The difficulty, height and style of their tricks will determine their scores. Alternative sports like BMX Freestyle and skateboarding are new to the Olympics, and some question their inclusion in the Games. But BMX event organizer Ryan van der Spy says sports like skateboarding and BMX just open up new doors for South African athletes.
The sports are Olympic sports now, especially looking at skateboarding and BMX freestyle. The biggest issue I think we have here locally is there's not enough facilities. So there's not enough facilities for riders and skaters to train on, get used to the competitive background of the sports.
Ligoni still has to hold down a job as a tattoo artist for the moment because he says he can't make a living riding full-time.
I did live for 2 years on just riding. It's not a living. You are scraping month to month. You know, you pay your medical aid, you pay for your car and your car insurance, and then so that's it, you're done.
Ligoni, who fell in love with riding BMX freestyle as a youngster, says the sport offers many life lessons for young BMX riders.
You learn how to be, like, persevere. When you're battling a trick for 5-6 hours the whole day and your body is sore, And you just got to keep trying. You got to just keep going and figuring it out. It teaches you, like, hey, sometimes things aren't going to work out and you got to be okay with that.
Being a trailblazer for the sport of BMX freestyle in South Africa, Ligoni now aims to do well at the Olympics and inspire and motivate more young people to pursue and participate in the sport. Hassan Hefaji, VOA News, Johannesburg, South Africa.
You are tuned to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up, the faith of democracy in the birthplace of democracy. Find out more after the break.
Hello, listener of South Sudan in Focus. We have an exciting new segment dubbed Words of Wisdom. We want to hear your thoughtful proverbs that echo through your community. This is another chance for you to share wisdom from your roots. All you need to do is record a proverb in a language of your choice, tell us its English translation and what it means. Keep it brief, authentic, and represent your community. Your recorded proverb shall be sampled on South Sudan in Focus every Wednesday. Send your recording via our WhatsApp number, +1 202 630 8011. That is +1 202 630 8011.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America. The malaria parasite is showing signs of resistance to the main drug used to fight the disease in parts of Africa. A new report warns of potentially millions of more deaths without immediate health policy changes. Henry Ridgewells has more from Bangkok.
It's estimated that over 1,000 children die every day from malaria in Africa, and there are fears that the death rate could rise. Artemisinin combination therapies, or ACTs, have been the cornerstone of malaria treatment for 20 years. But there are worrying signs that they are becoming less effective, says report co-author Lorenz von Seidlin of the Mahidol Oxford Tropical Medicine Research Unit in Bangkok.
We have increasing reports from Eastern Africa saying that they have documented resistance against the first-line treatments against malaria.
Artemisinin-resistant mutations have been detected in more than 10% of malaria cases in Ethiopia, Eritrea, Rwanda, Uganda, and Tanzania. Before artemisinin, chloroquine was the most widely used medicine to treat malaria. The report authors note that in the 1990s and early 2000s, signs that the malaria parasite was developing resistance to chloroquine were widely ignored. Again, Lorenz von Seidlin.
When the chloroquine resistance slowly sneaked into Africa, there was a whole wave of childhood mortality followed by it. So really a large number of children, probably in the millions, died because chloroquine didn't work as well as it used to do. And now we see these first signs that something similar is happening with the ACTs. And that is, of course, very worrying.
The paper, published in the journal Science, urges policymakers and global funding bodies to act now to prevent artemisinin resistance taking hold. Their recommendations include combining artemisinin drugs with other medicines in so-called triple artemisinin combination therapies, the rollout of new, more effective insecticides and mosquito nets, better training of community health workers, the rapid deployment of new malaria vaccines and better monitoring. Von Seidlin says many of these methods have been used to halt the spread of artemisinin resistance in Southeast Asia over the past decade. Again, Lorenz von Seidlin.
Ultimately, there was an understanding that this could be a major health emergency globally. And so there were a lot of investments from funders from high-income countries towards these countries in the greater Mekong sub-region to stop the spread of artemisinin-resistant parasites.
Scientists say that sense of urgency must now be applied to tackling artemisinin resistance in Africa. Henry Ridgewell, VOA News, Bangkok.
From matters to do with health, we now go for matters to do with crime. In South Africa, 95 Libyan nationals who were arrested at what authorities call a legal military camp in the country's rural north will appear in court today on charges of contravening immigration laws. The Libyans appear to belong to a Russian-led aligned militia fighting to topple the government in Tripoli. Darren Taylor reports from Johannesburg.
Police raided a farm near the small town of White River in Mpumalanga province on Friday. They found an assortment of military equipment, including firearms and ammunition. A police spokesperson says the Libyans misrepresented themselves on their visa applications, saying they'd be training as security guards. South Africa has some of the highest crime rates globally, with a current average of 84 murders per day. This, coupled with ineffective policing, has spawned a huge private security industry. The industry's regulators say at least 15,000 private security firms employ 2.8 million guards, dwarfing the number of state police officers in South Africa. It's not unusual for foreigners to train at South Africa's many private security companies, some owned by highly trained former police and army officers. But Institute of Security Studies expert Willem Els says the Libyans should never have been let into South Africa.
What raises a red flag is the country in question. Libya is currently a country in conflict, a failed state. Government of national unity in Libya is in control of less than 20% of the land. The rest of the country is under control of a militia under General Haftar. The rest, especially in the south, you've got various tribal militias. They dominate the ground there. But also you have ISIS and Al-Qaeda that have camps there and that are operating from there towards Mali and Mauritania and the other countries.
Els says General Khalifa Haftar's Eastern Alliance often sends fighters for military training abroad and often through foreign private companies.
Who sent those people here? Are they from the national government of national unity? Are they from some of the other militias? That will change the ballgame, and also that will make it a bit more serious. Information that we got is that it seems, and this is not being confirmed, but it seems that they come from the east of Libya, and that part is dominated by the militia of General Haftar and not the recognized government of Libya. That makes it more tricky for us.
It's tricky for South Africa because Haftar, who's fighting the United Nations-backed government in Tripoli for control of the oil-rich nation, is supported by Russia. South Africa's dominant party, the African National Congress, the ANC, has close ties with Moscow, recently penning military cooperation agreements with the Kremlin. The ANC denies facilitating the training of the Libyans. Haftar's administration in eastern Libya seems to have acknowledged it sent them. Shortly after news broke about their arrests, Haftar's foreign minister, Abdul al-Hawaij, posted on social media platform X that he'd arrange legal support for them. Private investigator and former top South African policeman Mike Bolles says it's difficult to believe local authorities didn't know about such an extensive base near a town with quite a large police presence.
So there is misrepresentation, and there is the possibility that certain authorities or corrupt policemen or security officers or institutions knew, and there is a possibility that they initially started as just training for a security company. Now that the authorities are on it, they should dissect it thoroughly. The concern is government corruption and police corruption.
Bolles told VOA it'll be a big mistake to simply deport the Libyans. If this happens, he says, it won't deter other militias or even terrorist groups from sending forces for training in South Africa. Bolles says the Libyans should at least be interrogated intensively to establish why they came here, who sent them, and what they were training for. He says the incident calls for an urgent review of all security-related training offered in South Africa. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
From Darren Taylor in Johannesburg with that crime story, we now move for politics. Democrats have warned that former President Donald Trump will destroy democratic institutions if re-elected to the highest office in the land in November. But Trump has said that democracy will end if he is not re-elected in 2024. VOA's Dora Misquar explores whether any president has the power to destroy democracy.
The Constitution is America's founding document. It outlines three branches of government: the executive, including the presidency, the legislative, the House of Representatives and the Senate, and the judicial, the Supreme Court and other courts. Each branch is intended to keep the others in check. This separation of powers is at the heart of American democracy. Ronald Chen is a law professor at Rutgers University.
We are navigating somewhat uncharted waters because of the assumed willingness of President Trump, if he were to be reelected, to explore the outer boundaries, including beyond where presidents had gone before.
I only want to be a dictator for one day. And I'm going to be a dictator, Sean, for one day.
Former President Donald Trump says he won't be a dictator beyond day one if he's reelected. But what if a future president did try to exceed his or her power? Here's Chen again.
If the allegation is that one branch is just simply going to run roughshod over the separation of powers, frankly, I don't know if it has yet been determined whether our system is strong enough to withstand that.
He has openly said he will be a dictator on day one.
One of the core campaign messages of likely Democratic presidential nominee Kamala Harris is that Trump is a threat to democracy. Democrats point to Trump's unwillingness to accept the results of the 2020 election and the subsequent January 6, 2021 attack on the Capitol.
Ours is a fight for freedom. Across our nation, we are witnessing a full-on assault on hard-fought, hard-won freedoms and rights.
They keep saying, he's a threat to democracy. I'm saying, what the hell did I do for democracy? Last week, I took a bullet for democracy.
Voters aren't necessarily buying into the argument that U.S. democracy is in peril. Chris Edelson is with American University.
I was talking to somebody a few weeks ago who said, you know, you hear all these things about Donald Trump trying to overthrow democracy, but he didn't do it.
David Ramadan of George Mason University.
There's some sentiment among some of the independent voters that, well, it worked. The system worked, right? The transfer of power did take place, so we're okay.
It's not easy for a populist leader to destroy democracy, according to Kurt Weiland, who studies democracy and authoritarian rule.
Only happens if there's some real institutional weakness and some very special conjunctural opportunity. And so my argument is that in the United States, those conditions really don't apply.
Violence says a number of factors limit a president from taking complete power, including good actors in public roles. He points to Georgia's Republican Secretary of State, Brad Raffensperger, who refused to help overturn the 2020 election when Trump asked him to find extra Trump votes.
American democracy is strong and resilient, and the American people are committed to it, and American office holders are committed to fulfilling their institutional duties.
Weiland says leaders have a better chance of destroying democracy when they have massive popular support, with approval ratings well over 70%. Trump's highest approval rating as president was 49%. Biden's was 57%. Dora McQuar, VOA News, Washington.
And that's all we prepared for you this Monday, July 29, 2024. We now leave you with Abdul Allison and a song about a good wife.
Nangunange, Napa Napuna, Adoke.
We have been listening to Abdul Allison and a song about a good wife. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Helen, we wish you a lovely evening. Remember to be with us again tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Agency for International Development recently announced a new policy on how best to promote a global renewal of democratic governance in light of nearly two decades of democratic backsliding. Shannon Green, the assistant to the administrator for the Bureau for Democracy, Human Rights, and Governance, explained the new policy.
It provides us with a blueprint for taking on new and evolving threats to DRG while doubling down on the proven investments in the institutions and actors who are so essential for democracy to rebound.
The decline of democracy is not inevitable, declared USAID Administrator Samantha Power in the recent policy announcement.
We see it in just the basic impulse people have to shape their own destinies, but that universal longing to decide for oneself, to be able to react against malfeasance or repression, to walk with dignity, and for your kids, above all, to be able to do that. These are powerful forces that should be underestimated, I think, at the peril of those repressive forces who again and again seek to do so.
The new Democracy, Rights, and Governance, or DRG, policy will modernize ongoing USAID support for frontline democracy defenders all over the world, said Administrator Power. It will also codify efforts to counter the rise of digital repression at its source.
We are working with lawyers, judges, legislatures, and other oversight organizations to develop national strategies and standards around the use of technologies. We are supporting initiatives that seek to increase transparency about the way elected leaders are using technology and the way they are using individual data.
A big part of the DRG policy will be to create initiatives that develop a political culture that respects democratic norms, said Administrator Power.
It is only with a culture of integrity, honesty, and accountability that our work strengthening institutions is going to have its desired lasting effect. It's only if judges are impartial that justice systems can enforce the rule of law. It is only if incumbents allow genuine competition and, of course, accept the will of the people that elections ultimately will be free and fair.
USAID is committed to partnering with organizations working to promote informed, factual, and peaceful discourse, with the ultimate goal of once again expanding democratic governance.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.